Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. The Democratic National Convention is over. The Democrats have had their say, and Joe Biden is the official Democratic nominee for president. But is the unity we saw on stage this week among Democrats, progressives, and moderates something that will last? This hour on Point, unity among the Democrats and the way forward for us all. With us this hour from Easton, Maryland, is E.J. Dion. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, a professor at Georgetown University, a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings Institution, and the author of many, many books, among them his most recent, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. E.J. Dion, always great to have you here at On Point. Thanks for being here.
And so good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So in your latest book, which was published in February, you call on the Democratic Party to find some sort of unity between moderates and progressives. February seems like a world away now, but I'm
sure
curious.
Does.
Yes. During the convention this week, I'm curious, did you see some of that unity that you've been calling for?
Yeah, in fact, it was unmistakable. As you know, the first two sentences of my book are, will progressives and moderates feud while America burns, or will these natural allies take advantage of a historic opportunity to strengthen American democracy and defeat an increasingly radical form of conservatism? And I think that's exactly what you saw this week. You saw it in the way Bernie Sanders gave a really passionate speech about the importance of electing Joe Biden. You heard it in what Elizabeth Warren said in a very forceful way about Biden. But you also saw it in the way in which these two sides, whether you call them moderate or center left and the more progressive end of the party, came together around a series of issues that they had been arguing about for the previous year. And what I argued in the book is what seemed to come to pass, which is they said to each other, look, we have disagreements on particulars, but we want to move in the same direction. So Democrats don't necessarily agree on whether single-payer health care is the way to get health insurance to everyone, but they certainly agree that every American should have access to affordable, good health insurance. And so Biden and Warren and Sanders all came together around an idea, let's expand the number of people on Medicare by lowering the eligibility age to 60, and then let's get to the rest by finishing up what Obamacare started with a public option. And you saw that on access to college. You saw that on climate change, where Biden already had a pretty strong climate plan, but he strengthened it. And so what you're seeing here is, A, the extraordinary importance of preventing a second Trump term. And I thought President Obama gave as forceful a case as anyone about the threat to democracy itself that Trump posed, but also the importance of solving a series of underlying problems whose severity has only been underscored by the pandemic and the economic downturn. So, yeah, I felt very heartened this week as a citizen, but also in terms of the book I wrote, because I think this is the direction that both progressives and more moderate people in the country need to take.
So you mentioned some specific issues, some of which we'll dive into this hour. And I hear you. There was a lot of unity talk, a lot of kumbaya this week. But you know, EJ, you know, on social media, a lot of progressives were grumbling about all those Republican defectors in their proverbial tent this week, the John Kasichs and the Chuck Hagels and the Cindy McCains and Colin Powell. Oh, my goodness. Part of the Iraq war push, you know. So on the one hand, it confirmed for a lot of progressive Democrats this week the worst fears about a possible Biden presidency, a moderate presidency. And on the other hand, you hear Joe Biden, you know, he knows he needs those moderate voters to win the election. So talk about that tension point, that tension within the Democratic Party, especially right now.
Well, I think that, first of all, you didn't hear as many complaints about Republicans at the convention among an awful lot of very progressive Democrats like Sanders and Warren, who understand that, you know, given the way Donald Trump is threatening to stay in office, threatening to say the election is illegitimate with all kinds of basically lies about mail voting, it's important not only to win the election, but win it decisively. And that will only happen if people who aren't Democrats, including some Republicans, vote for Joe Biden to build up that margin. But yes, you're right. There is some unease about which way will Biden go as president. And I think the indications he's given on so many substantive questions are the reason why people like Warren and Sanders are comfortable with a Biden presidency. Of course, there'll be arguments among Democrats. In a two-party system, parties are very, very broad coalitions. And so the Democratic Party will have tensions in it. There will be arguments over how tough to be on Wall Street. What do you do about breaking up monopolies? All those kinds of questions will definitely arise. But I think that the thrust of the party it now is unmistakably progressive. And you see it in Biden himself. The Biden of 2020 is more progressive than the Biden who got elected in 1972. Mm-hmm. And I dare say the Biden who became vice president under Barack Obama, his leading the way on same-sex marriage is a good example. Mm-hmm. On the social issues of how people in very large numbers have moved in a more progressive direction in the country. I've joked that after the 2008 economic crash, it wasn't that sort of the Democratic Party had moved to the left. Reality had moved to the left. Attitudes toward capitalism had become more critical. And whether you thought of yourself as a progressive capitalist or a democratic socialist, those two sides agreed that more needed to be done to create a more just economic system that distributed its fruits more fairly. I think there is broad consensus on that.
Here is Joe Biden speaking last night at the DNC multiple times. During his speech, he called for unity and a coming together in his party and broadly speaking to beat Donald Trump. Here he is from last night.
In times as challenging as these, I believe there's only one way forward. As a united America, united in our pursuit of a more perfect union, united in our dreams of a better future for us and for our children, united in our determination to make the coming years bright. Are you ready? I believe we are.
So, E.J. Dionne, how much of this is about pulling together to beat Donald Trump? And then if Joe Biden wins come January, that's when the infighting in the Democratic Party really begins.
I'm not unrealistic about the differences, and people ought to fight their corners in internal policy debates. But I'm really not as pessimistic as others are that somehow Biden wins and all of a sudden everything falls apart and everyone is at each other's throats. Why do I think that? Because the problems the country faces right now are so profound, both in terms of the virus and in terms of the economic mess and the ways in which the pandemic has underscored some of the deep inequalities in the country. Biden has made a point of saying over and over again, we shouldn't just honor essential workers, we should actually pay them. And so I think that in the need to solve a large series of problems, the different wings of the Democratic Party, well, yeah, they will argue about the architecture of some of the solutions, They will argue about how far can the party go in reforming and fundamentally changing the country and what will get through Congress, assuming the Democrats take control of the Senate. But the fact is that the size of the problems, I think, is going to force people on the various sides of the argument to say, all right, we want this, but we'll settle for that because the compromise is way better than what we have now. And then we'll fight another day for the rest of it. I use some examples from the past of where that happened. The original Social Security law under FDR did not go nearly as far as it should have. It excluded African Americans by the way they defined the job categories that were covered by Social Security and not covered. It took many years to make Social Security the broad program it is today. And I look at sort of the healthcare improvements that way. Step by step, we can cover everyone. I think now is the time to take the final step to covering everybody. And then we can argue about the architecture of a universal coverage plan going forward. Under FDR, there was a functional relationship between what I might call the governing liberal center in FDR and the left, which then took the form of a very strong voice in the labor movement in the CIO. The CIO brought real pressure on Roosevelt to move in a progressive direction, but the CIO also gave Roosevelt critical support against his right-wing adversaries. And I think what we need is a functional relationship between the progressive movement and, again, I'll call it a governing liberal center. And that's how our country has made progress on civil rights, on social justice, and a whole series of other questions.
We are discussing the Democratic Party with columnist and author E.J. Dionne, author and columnist for The Washington Post. He's a government professor at Georgetown. His most recent book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. There's so much more to get to after this break. We'll be back. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the Democratic Party and its future this hour. In remarks on Monday night at the Democratic National Convention, Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders said that over the last 4 years, authoritarianism has taken root in America. And he said it's time for all of us to work together to defeat it.
I and my family, and many of yours, know the insidious way authoritarianism destroys democracy, decency, and humanity. As long as I am here, I will work with progressives, with moderates, and yes, with conservatives to preserve this nation from a threat that so many of our heroes fought and died to defeat.
With me this hour is author and columnist E.J. Dionne. His most recent book is Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. I hear Bernie Sanders there, E.J., and, you know, I think of one of the most unexpected developments in American politics is this resurgence of Democratic socialism. And I'd like you to talk for a couple of minutes about how young people in this country view socialism through a very different prism than older Americans, who often equate socialism with, you know, absolute control over the economy and other things. You write that young people see socialism as Denmark or Sweden, where government guarantees healthcare and college and the rest. And older people think of it as a more repressive sort of Soviet Union model. EJ, talk about that difference and how that's impacting the party in this moment.
Right. And I just want to underscore something Bernie Sanders said in that clip you played, which I think was a very important clip from the convention. There is the old line, you know, the prospect of being hanged, sir, concentrates the mind wonderfully. And to have Bernie Sanders out there saying, look, when authoritarianism is on the ballot, when there is the threat that democracy itself will be unraveled by a second Trump term, the need for a broad alliance against it is urgent. And so I think that was a really important intervention by Sanders. But you're right, the book really talks a lot about how democratic socialism in the minds of young people is what democratic socialism was supposed to be in the first place, which is democratic. They did not live through the Cold War, young people. They did not live through the era of the Soviet Union, of Stalinism, of the kind of repression that came to be associated with communism and then by extension with socialism. That's how many older Americans look at socialism. But moreover, young people have lived through a time when capitalism itself has not worked as the wonderful job-producing, income-producing, broad income-producing mechanism that lovers of capitalism claim for it. It ran into severe problems. It has created some really broad inequalities going back really to the early 1980s. Some might measure it even into the 1970s. So young people say, look, we think that there are societies out there. And Bernie, when he talks, he doesn't talk about the Soviet Union. He does talk, as you said, about Sweden, about Denmark, about Norway, places where there is a market. They are market economies, but they have a far greater concern for social goods. Healthcare is a social good. Pensions are guaranteed. Unions are stronger in those countries. And AOC has spoken in a similar way about her vision of what democratic socialism means. It's much more about broadly social democratic countries than it ever is about state socialist countries along Soviet lines.
But also, EJ, these younger voters, beyond the social goods and the pensions and the unions that you speak of, these younger progressive democratic socialists in the party today really have little interest in forging bipartisan consensus on issues, right? They want big change, they want big accomplishments, and they want it now. So I go back to this question, if Joe Biden becomes president, isn't there going to be some sort of reckoning with that Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party, regardless of what they're all saying at the convention?
You know, bipartisan consensus when it comes to defeating Donald Trump is different from bipartisan consensus governing. I don't think Biden, and certainly I don't think most of the leaders of the party, Biden speaks fondly of the Republicans he's known in the past. And there was that lovely video of his friendship with John McCain. But I don't think anyone is expecting the Republican Party to come around and say they are now trying to get rid of Obamacare, to come around and say, actually, we want to extend health insurance to everyone else. So that I think that you will, in the end, be having an argument, a negotiation, a debate within the Democratic Party. And I think take a look at the House of Representatives right now. One of the things I talk about a lot in the book, at the beginning of the book, are the 2018 elections and how you build a broad progressive majority. And I talk about people like AOC in New York, Ayanna Pressley up in Massachusetts, who won in 2018, who are firm, strong progressives. But you built that majority also with people like Mikey Sherrill of New Jersey, Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, who are more, no, by the way, I've named all women because mm-hmm. the rise and the power of women in the 2018 elections is a very important fact of life in our politics. And they have had some disagreements with each other in that Democratic majority, but they passed an awful lot of legislation, which the Senate has turned down. And if any of those bills ever became law, whether on health care or on political reform, they would create very substantial change in the country. And one other thing, if I could, because we haven't brought it up, I think it's very important to look at the Democratic convention and notice how important racial justice was in the thematics of this convention all the way through from the very beginning to the roll call and the nature of the messages that came through in that roll call. The killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor have created a mass movement for racial justice that has clearly affected most people in the country, but especially the Democratic Party. And I thought this convention was rather uncompromising in saying that racial justice must be a central theme of the next administration.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation at this moment. Charlene Carruthers joins me from Chicago. She's a political strategist, author, and community organizer. She's the founder of the Chicago Center for Leadership and Transformation. She is the founding national director of Black Youth Project 100, and she serves on the steering committee of the organization Black Women 4. She is the author of the book Unapologetic, A Black, Queer, and Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements. Charlene Carruthers, nice to have you on Point. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So this is such an interesting conversation with E.J. Dionne about the Democratic Party, about progressives and moderates and sort of where we are now, where are we moving toward. You were an Elizabeth Warren supporter originally, so I'm curious as a progressive how you're feeling about the convention this week. Has it met your expectations?
Well, you know, I first attended a Democratic convention, I believe it was back in 2012 for the first time. And I remember being a much younger organizer and activist and really beginning to learn how the Democratic Party operates. And in this particular moment where people are calling for unity, I think it's especially important to, you know, as someone who did support Senator Elizabeth Warren, as someone who has politics that are frankly farther left than the majority of or the mainstream of the Democratic Party, to really dig into the fact that unity doesn't mean that we all of a sudden become homogenous. And I think that that was one of the things that I know that's one of the things that attracted me to Senator Warren was her attention to detail and differences. And to many other Democrats that we some of the Democrats, I should say, that we heard this week at the convention. And so I don't look to the convention to meet all of my needs. The convention is to solidify the Democratic presidential candidate, right? And to solidify the vice presidential candidate and to solidify the party platform.
But do you think
the floor, not the ceiling?
Yeah. But do you think Joe Biden is prioritizing your progressive policy goals enough? Healthcare, climate, I mean, go down the list.
I don't believe that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party's platform has gone far enough. Again, it's the floor and not the ceiling. What we are calling for, as E.J. Dionne mentioned earlier in the conversation, we want big, bold changes. We actually want nothing short of transformation. What you're seeing and hearing on the streets, and maybe not as much as the cameras have gone away, are people calling for a transformation. They're calling for a country that actually prioritizes people over property. They're calling for things like the defunding of law enforcement and the funding of public schools and anti-violence programs that create real public safety. And while the Democratic Party, and particularly the convention this week, gave lip service to and gave space to racial justice and is centering racial justice more squarely than folks may say they have in the past, we want that to actually show up in policy. Healthcare for all is a racial justice issue, right? Climate justice is a racial justice issue. All of those things to us are connected in addition to transforming how the criminal legal system functions in this country.
So it is true that there is a lot of energy in the progressive wing in the party. You want, as you say, big, bold changes. You want transformation. You want it now. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, Charlene, hasn't it been borne out historically and especially in this moment that a winning coalition tends to come from the middle. It comes from the center.
Well, in my study of history, I am a historian. It's not in my biography, but I am an historian.
Okay.
In my understanding of history, a winning coalition comes as a result of people pushing transformative ideas, right? Someone has to put it out there. Someone had to say that chattel slavery had to end, right? Someone had to say that economic and racial segregation of Jim Crow had to end and that people deserve their full dignity. And frankly, when I hear people say that, you know, not right now, you need to wait longer, if we only took that position, we wouldn't even be at this point to have this conversation right now. There always has to be a flank of people, everyday people, who are saying that we want more, because there's also always a flank of people saying we want you to have less. And so those two poles together shouldn't always come in. The middle shouldn't be that the folks who have always been on the margins have to sacrifice, have to compromise. We have to move what we believe is a compromise farther and farther, not just farther left, but to be much more expansive and much bigger and have much more room for people to live within their full dignity.
So when you have a big tent political party like the Democratic Party is trying to pitch right now, it is hard to keep order, right? By definition, you have a lot of competing voices. What do you think moderates and progressives can learn from each other?
Mm-hmm. I think that I think about people like Representative Ayanna Pressley, who E.J. Dionne mentioned earlier, what folks can learn from, you know, a congresswoman who is ideally, hopefully going into her next term as a congresswoman. And she has stepped up and endorse the BREATHE Act, which is an act created by the Movement for Black Lives calling for divestment of our taxpayer dollars from discriminatory policing and actually investing in a new vision of public safety. She stepped out. She stepped out. There are other congresswomen and congresspeople who are stepping out and saying, I'm actually going to lead the edge of what is possible in this country. And I actually think those are the people folks should listen to. On one hand, they say, trust black women. Black women voters will save the Democratic Party. Black women will save the country. Liberals have said this. But on the other hand, are you listening to the black women in Congress who are stepping forth with bold ideas? Mm-hmm. Because there's something to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what moderates and progressives need to do, is to take a sober assessment of how we've gotten to where we've gotten now and know that tinkering around the edge is not enough. And it's not okay to leave people out. Because what if the Social Security Act, upon its initial passing, actually did take the time and did not exclude black people? We're still dealing with the legacies of black people or African Americans being left out of legislation to this day. And so how much longer are people supposed to suffer and wait? I mean, we're committed to the fight. So I'm actually excited about where we are in this moment to continue to push the Democratic Party. But frankly, not all politics reside in the Democratic and the Republican Party. Our work is much broader than that.
E.J. Dionne, jump back in here. What are you hearing in Charlene Carruthers' comments?
Well, first of all, I want to identify completely with something she said early on, which is she said, unity doesn't mean being homogeneous. And no political movement that's successful, no progressive movement in our history has ever been homogeneous. There is always pulling and tugging when we are fighting for change. And I also agree with her that to me, there are two kinds of moderation. There is a kind of moderation that is an excuse for inaction. And that kind of moderation, Martin Luther King wrote about in one of the great documents in our history, is a letter from Birmingham jail, where he talked about the moderate who said, yes, but not yet. He talked about the tranquilizing drug of gradualism in his great speech in 1963 at the Civil Rights March. But there's another kind of moderation that says, yes, we have problems, and yes, we need to negotiate through to a successful solution. And so what you had are activists like Charlene putting pressure in the civil rights years, first on John F. Kennedy, and then after his assassination on Lyndon Johnson, to get things done. I think the issue is, what path are we on? What direction are we moving in? I quite agree, by the way, that it was actually quite outrageous that this original Social Security Act was written as it was to pander to Southern Democratic committee chairs. And it took a long time to include African Americans under Social Security. On the other hand, look at the Democratic Party now. The white supremacists who you were there at FDR's convention in 1932 aren't there anymore. The last point I want to make is just on this whole question of arguments over so-called identity politics and why this new movement for racial justice is so important. In the book, I quote Stacey Abrams, who said, "The marginalized did not create identity politics. Their identities have been forced on them by dominant groups, and politics is the most effective method of revolt." That's why Stacey Abrams ran for governor of Georgia, and she would have been governor without voter suppression. And that's the kind of politics where you can have a non-homogeneous coalition. That's what coalitions are, and actually make progress. And so I identified with a lot of what Charlaine said.
I have to take a break. We have much more to come on the other side. It's such an interesting discussion. We are talking about the Democratic Party and how to heal the divisions within it with E.J. Dionne, author and columnist for The Washington Post, author of Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country, and Charlene Carruthers, political strategist, author, and community organizer, author of Unapologetic. Much more to come after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf.
That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. On Monday, On Point, the spotlight swivels to the other side of the aisle for the opening night of the Republican National Convention. How does the presidential race look from your community? Did you vote for President Trump in 2016? Will you vote for him again? Why or why not? We'd love to hear your story at 617-353-0683. Today, we're discussing the Democratic Party and its future. I'm joined by E.J. Dionne, columnist and author, and also Charlene Carruthers, political strategist, author, and community organizer based in Chicago. Let me get in a couple of these clips. This is former Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich speaking on Monday night at the Democratic National Convention. He called on Republicans to leave partisanship aside and vote for Biden.
I'm sure there are Republicans and independents who couldn't imagine crossing over to support a Democrat. They fear Joe may turn sharp left and leave them behind. I don't believe that because I know the measure of the man. It's reasonable, faithful, respectful. And you know, no one pushes Joe around. Joe Biden is a man for our times, times that call for all of us to take off our partisan hats and put our nation first for ourselves and, of course, for our children.
And here is Senator Kamala Harris speaking on Wednesday night at the convention. She is the first woman of color on a major party ticket. She spoke of younger voters, praising them for continuing to push for American ideals.
I'm so inspired by a new generation. You are pushing us to realize the ideals of our nation, pushing us to live the values we share. Decency and fairness, justice and love. You are patriots who remind us that to love our country is to fight for the ideals of our country.
Charmaine Carruthers, what do you make of Kamala Harris? She's been, shall we say, wobbly on some issues that are important to progressive voters. Medicare for All, for example. First she supported it, then she didn't. What do you make of her track record? And is she enough for you as a progressive woman?
Mm-hmm. So I voted in every single election since I was 18 years old. I always vote. And I show up to vote, and I become clear that it is about, and I organize every single day of the year, all year round rather, because I understand that it is about shaping the political terrain that I want to live in and then I want to organize within. And so when I think about Senator Harris, I'm clear about her record as a prosecutor, as someone who has been complicit and had a leadership role in a system that continues to criminalize, to imprison, and frankly kill Black and brown people every single day. What I'm also clear about is that she is the vice presidential nominee on the Democratic Party ticket, and that is who I will see. I will see Joe Biden on the ballot. And so what I'm interested in this moment is her making a choice to actually reconcile her actions in the past with where we need to go moving forward. I'm not interested in relitigating what she's done at this moment because we're here and I want to be grounded in reality. And so she has an opportunity to get on board with the young people that she's speaking of right now. She has an opportunity to become an advocate for the things that we're calling for, because true patriotism in this moment, it should be about transforming this country. As, you know, the so-called patriots who also were okay with chattel slavery did, you know, hundreds of years ago. And so I think this is an opportunity for reconciliation with her and to make a different choice and to move forward. And I want nothing short of that. And again, I've mentioned the BREATHE Act. There are other things that she can get behind. I'm very much so committed to the cancellation of student loan, a student loan that people carry across this country. And I hesitate to call it debt because it shouldn't be even debt. We shouldn't even have to hold it, right? So those are my feelings about Senator Harris. I don't think it serves us. It doesn't serve me to continue to litigate what she has done in the past. I'm really concerned with how she's going to move forward in the future.
EJ Dion, this, what Charlene is talking about reminds me of what you discuss in the book. You talk about visionary gradualism, you know, this term that sort of captures this core argument that moderates and progressives have more in common than they want to realize. And I'm thinking for progressives, gradualism is a bit of a dirty word. Is it not? What are you hearing in Charlene there?
No, I find the way Charlene is talking is really very realistic in my view, and I think it's consistent with what I argue as to how change happens. One of the interesting things about that term visionary gradualism that I like so much is that it was coined by a democratic socialist. It was coined by the late Michael Harrington, who was the key founder of Democratic Socialists of America way back in the early 70s. And what Harrington argued, and I think this is something that more moderate liberals and progressives agree on, which is if you are not visionary, if you do not have large goals, then you can't set your compass anywhere, and changes you make are probably going to be ephemeral. So you need the vision. But what gradualism means in Harrington's definition is that often in our history, in so many areas, change has come step by step. There were a couple of weak civil rights bills passed in the 19th or inadequate, but they helped pave the way for the strong Voting Rights Act of Civil Rights Act of 1965 and four, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Change often comes step by step. What matters is that you agree that the steps you agree on the steps you take. And if we got to a point, for example, on healthcare, where every American is covered in a mixed system, we can then argue going forward, should we transform this mixed system into a Medicare for All system, or do we end up with a mixed system that we think on the whole is working for the people who need the most help? And we can have that argument. But we can't even get there right now until we cover everyone with health insurance. And I think that's true in so many areas. Joe Biden endorsed free college for people earning, for families earning under $145,000 a year. That's a huge step. And that was a direct response to some of the pressure that people in Bernie Sanders' movement brought.
Right. But EJ, I mean, a lot of people would say change has not been gradual on a lot of Democratic progressive issues. It's been swift. I mean, there's been a huge shift on social issues alone within the Democratic Party, as you made reference to 12 years ago in 2008. Gay marriage was still not in the Democratic Party platform. Barack Obama said he didn't support it during the 2008 campaign. And beyond social issues, there have been huge swings on climate and health care. 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders was way out in left field. Medicare for all, a single-payer plan. You know, there's been this sort of mainstreaming of formerly radical ideas. There has been a swift acceleration to the left within the party. Is that not true, EJ?
Well, as I argue in the book, I think something very big happened in 2008, 2009, and that's where Occupy Wall Street came from. And so I think since 2008, there has been a decided move to the left in a lot of people's attitudes toward the economy. Even some Republicans are talking about the market differently than they did before 2008. Mm-hmm. But if you take gay marriage, Stonewall happened, if my memory serves, in 1969. And so the gay rights movement was really born in in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And we got to same-sex marriage as a matter of law in the 2000s. So I think a lot of it depends on what your perspective is on what gradualism means. There was Philip Randolph back in the 40s began agitating for a civil rights law that didn't happen until 1964. But you can have very big steps. And I think this is a moment because of the pandemic, because of the economic problems in the country, where Americans are much readier to take big steps than they were before the pandemic and certainly before 2008.
Charlene, do you agree with that?
Well, at each turn in history where we have massive change, it oftentimes happens, if not often, just it happens because everyday people organize and people are poised to organize. And there are some issues that actually you can't just gradually shift. Like we couldn't gradually end like chattel slavery. It had to happen, right? It wasn't simply just a piece of legislation that made it happen. It was an actual war that got us to this point. And even Stonewall in the beginnings, that is a beginning of the LGBTQ rights movement, is not the only beginning. I mean, Marsha P. Johnson and the many people who led that rebellion are significant. But marriage equality did not free LGBTQI plus people. That is one piece of policy. The arc towards full gender justice and LGBTQI plus justice is much longer than any piece of legislation. And I think when we have our conversations about laws and they're limited to that, it actually limits what this visionary gradualism that you're pointing to, EJ Dion. I think any shifts that we have in the Democratic Party, yes, there are owed to Occupy Wall Street. They're also owed to the movement for Black Lives or Black Lives Matter. We're talking about people who hit the streets, people who ran for office, people who shifted budgets, people who changed educational systems, people who are doing work globally to move not just the Democratic Party, but the popular consciousness or the hearts and minds of everyday people in this country. We didn't get here on accident. We know that people are hitting the streets because we are in a global pandemic and they were given $1,200 to survive a global pandemic. And it's woefully insufficient. And they're also seeing people, in case in point in Chicago, the Chicago Police Department has a budget of about $1.7 billion a year. That money goes towards the police department while our neighborhoods on the south and west sides of Chicago crumble. And so the shifts that we're seeing, they're swift because people made them swift. People push politicians and people are actually creating the changes that they want to see on the ground. And that's why I'm excited, y'all. It's not simply because we have a chance to get Donald Trump out of office. We have a chance to stop the mass deportation and incarceration of undocumented migrants. We have all these chances to do these things. I'm excited because everyday people are organizing every single day.
Could I come in here, Jane, just sure. Because I so believe in an inside-outside strategy. I think that we have a lot of fruitless arguments, and Charlene is not making a fruitless argument. I think I'm agreeing with her that if you only focus on electoral politics, you miss something important. And absolutely. If you only focus on outside organizing, you miss something important. Mm. The way progress is made is through interaction between electoral politics and the organizing that goes on in the streets and the organizing that goes on in neighborhoods. We have never achieved fundamental change without organizing, but we've also never achieved fundamental change until we elected people who were open to listening to the voices of change. And our politics, you know, progressive politics, I think works best when there is this functional relationship between people doing the organizing and people who are passing the laws.
We just have a couple of minutes left here. I'm just curious, both of your thoughts on the work that lies ahead for not only the Democratic Party, but for the Republican Party as well. E.J. Dionne, I'll begin with you.
Well, I think that the Republicans are going to try to paint Joe Biden as someone he isn't next week. They're going to try to scare people about Joe Biden. And it's pretty hard to scare people about Joe Biden. And the Democrats, I think, did a reasonable job of inoculating him against a lot of those attacks. But they certainly demonized Hillary Clinton effectively 4 years ago. And that's one thing they're going to try to do, but it's not easy. The second thing that's going to be really hard is to put a positive face on Donald Trump's record. And that's why I think that, you know, I think they're not going to focus as much on that as on attacking the other side. They were already going after Kamala Harris, and they're going to try to ignite a right-wing base to turn them out. I guess the one critique I might have of the Democratic Convention is I wish they had focused a bit more on economic issues and issues of economic justice. They did some of that. They had an awful lot of rank and file union members on the screen, which was good. But I think that Trump is going to try to pretend that Joe Biden would somehow wreck the economy more than the virus and Trump's handling of it already has. And that's where I see them trying to go. But I think they got a really hard road because large parts of the country have shifted against Donald Trump. And I don't know how they can get them back.
Charlene Carruthers, about a minute left for you here. What's the work that lies ahead for the Democratic Party and for the Republican Party?
Well, the work that lies ahead for both of the parties is contending with a massive base of people across the country and people across the world who are in solidarity with us, who are calling for governance in how this country is governed and saying that actually what's on the books is not okay. It's inherently not working for us. Be it the two-party system, the way that decisions are made, the way our voting system works, it is inherently like, while there are some shining parts to it, some shining moments, it's not what we need. And that we're actually poised to continue to organize, and so they shouldn't get complacent. They shouldn't get comfortable and think just because if we have a Joe Biden, Senator Harris victory in November, there's no guarantee that, like, Trumpism doesn't go away just because Donald Trump possibly goes away. And so they should be poised for us to continue to organize and for us to continue to push for not just a Band-Aid or a slightly better country, but one where the understanding of dignity is about people, our relationship to each other, and the land that we live on. And that is about the economy, that's about the environment, and it's absolutely about...
Oh, I'm hanging on that last word. Oh. Charlene, I know. Darn.
Wanted to hear where that was going.
I did, me too. You want to end it for her in 5 seconds here, EJ?
We really have a choice of moving forward or moving backward in this election. I think Bernie had it absolutely right. The threat of authoritarianism should be foremost in our mind. And the possibility of change should be there too. And the only way forward will be to get rid of Trump. And then we can have a much better set of arguments in the country.
Well, a lot to think about after this hour. Charlene Carruthers, thank you. E.J. Dionne, always great to hear from you. Thank you.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And have a good weekend, everyone. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.